Wednesday, July 1st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, the United States and Cuba move to end decades of political isolation. China approves a controversial national security law.
This really, I think, is an unmistakable sign of the political hardening that we're witnessing at the moment under Xi Jinping.
And Meghan Trainor teams up with John Legend for a new song. It's all ahead. After nearly 7 months of negotiations, the United States and Cuba are announcing today an agreement to reopen embassies in Washington and Havana. The U.S. Embassy in Havana is expected to reopen later this month, and Secretary of State John Kerry has indicated he will attend the flag-raising ceremony. In Washington on Tuesday, visiting Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff welcomed warming relations and its impact on the rest of Latin America. VOA's Victor Beatty asked Latin American analyst Mark Jones of Rice University in Houston about her comments.
What the Brazilian president was referring to is the fact that our Cuba relations have been a real obstacle to deeper U.S. relations and U.S. activity in Latin America. Our U.S. foreign policy vis-a-vis Cuba is seen as archaic and indefensible even by our allies, let alone is seen as imperialism by our enemies. And by moving to thaw relations between the two countries and establish formal diplomatic relations, what President Obama has done is remove a important but a relatively unproductive obstacle to better U.S. relations with Latin American countries. And it will both allow our allies to deepen their relationship with us and also provide one less excuse for our opponents to either stifle or maintain relations with the United States in a relatively tenuous manner.
Mark, as you know, there are still issues between the two countries that have yet to be resolved. Cuba's human rights record, demands for compensation for confiscated U.S. properties seized decades ago, damages to Cuba from the embargo, possible cooperation on law enforcement, including the topic of U.S. fugitives sheltering in Havana. Will these issues follow?
Certainly, there are a large number of unanswered issues in U.S.-Cuba relations, just as there are between many countries, but especially in this case, given the absence of diplomatic relations for more than 50 years. What the establishment of formal diplomatic relations with an embassy will do is allow the countries to begin addressing this host of issues that face both countries, be it human rights violations in Cuba and issues regarding compensation for U.S. citizens, and then also issues related to fugitives from U.S. justice who are residing presently in Cuba and doing something about that for people who've been committed of capital crimes, a murder, for instance, in the United States and fled to Cuba. Cuba is likely to be less and less of a safe haven for those individuals in years to come.
Mark Jones of Rice University. In a statement, Florida Congresswoman Elena Ross-Leighton denounced the move to reopen an embassy as emboldening the Castro regime to continue its attacks against the Cuban people. She said opening the embassy will do nothing to help the Cuban people and is just another trivial attempt for President Obama to go legacy shopping. Ted Henkin, Cuba analyst at Baruch College in New York, tells Victor Beatty the anti-regime policies Ross-Leighton supports have done nothing to improve the human rights of the Cuban people.
She's on the wrong side of history on this topic. I mean, I respect her because she is consistently critical of Cuban violations of human rights, and she's right about that. But I disagree with her in terms of the strategy. Her strategy, the one that she favors, has failed, and she's on the wrong side of this issue. Having diplomatic relations with Cuba doesn't mean we approve of the Cuban government, nor does it mean we approve of their treatment of the Cuban people. I think we'll have better chance of having some kind of influence in Cuba with a relationship that's engaging and empowering than one that is isolating and impoverishing the government and the people.
Ted, as you know, of course, travel and communication restrictions have been eased. Business is beginning to pick up between the two countries. You have tourists beginning to travel to Cuba in increasing numbers. Is any of this going to change Cuba's communist government?
I don't think that we should hope it does. I think our changing of our policies is about American interests, American values, American influence, not about regime change. I think that the Cuban people should be the ones who decide about what kind of regime, what kind of government, what kind of system of government they have. Right now, they don't have a whole lot of power to do that. Cuba is a dictatorship. But isolating the dictatorship has not worked. I think focusing on empowering the people should be our main objective, because by trying to hurt the government has used that as a scapegoat and has put most of the burden on the Cuban people. I think that this is not a silver bullet, and we shouldn't understand it to be a silver bullet. It's not a concession to the dictatorship. It's a concession to the U.S. people. It's a concession to pragmatism and to common sense, and a concession to our own interests. And I think that that's why it was done. It's not a gift to the Cuban government. There are many areas where we disagree with Cuba, the government, but there are also many areas where we can benefit from collaboration. Environmental issues, drug interdiction issues are important. Military cooperation when there are refugees picked up at sea is important. I think there are many areas that we can collaborate on, we kind of have the same interests on, and I think our negative relationship has prevented that from really deepening. Beyond the areas of culture, of religion, of families, and all of these areas can deepen now the relationships, now that there's an official kind of relationship between the governments.
That's Ted Henken of Baruch College. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Polshevsky with a look at what's trending. So, Andrew, what's happening?
Well, in this U.S.-Cuba issue, it's very interesting. We're seeing people kind of split along the lines we see politically. We have a lot of people in social media that are praising this announcement, saying it's going to be another step in the right direction. We have other people that are saying it's terrible. It's legitimizing the Cuban regime. And then we have people that are taking their own interesting opinions on it, people saying, I hope this means I can go vacation in Cuba sooner rather than later. Well, one person asking, what's going to happen now to Guantanamo, the U.S. Military base in Guantanamo? People also asking, who's the ambassador? Who's going to be this ambassador to Cuba? So a lot of questions still yet to be answered and a lot of buzz on social media about that. We've talked about on the show several times Prime Minister Narendra Modi of India and how he's very savvy on social media, sometimes to his detriment when he puts his foot in his mouth in social media. But it's a good week for him. He's announced a Digital India initiative, the idea being to connect the country and make it more digitally forward to create new business opportunities. So that's trending on social media this morning, people saying that that's a great step forward for the country. And another story that we had actually on the voanews.com website, there's another campaign that he's launched called Save Daughter, Teach Daughter. And what this campaign does, it asks fathers to take selfies with their daughters, pictures of themselves and their daughters, and post it on social media. The idea being India has a lot of termination of pregnancies when parents find out they're having a girl. It's a very male-focused society, and they're trying to stop that. So this hashtag, Selfie with Daughter, was trending, and it's become a way for India to use social media to try to stop this trend.
And show pride in their daughters.
And show pride in their daughters, absolutely. So that's been something that's been trending, and that's another way that he's using social media, a very forward way he's doing that to do some good. There's another woman, Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. She is an author from Nigeria, and she gave a TED talk where she was talking about being a feminist and started this hashtag, being female in Nigeria, where women are going online and saying, being female in Nigeria means men say, oh, why aren't you married? Men think less of me because I'm a woman, so exposing a lot of the sexist attitudes there and using social media and this hashtag to do that.
All right. Thanks very much. That's social media editor Andrew Polshevsky. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
June 30th was Asteroid Day, a day to create global awareness about the potential danger giant asteroids pose to Earth and what can be done to protect our planet. So, how many of these threatening asteroids are out there? Mario DeLeo Winkler is at the University of California, Riverside.
We do have a list of around 1,500 potentially hazardous objects. Those are a very small percentage of the actual asteroids that exist out there, around 3%. So right now, we don't have an object that is a potential hazard.
Most scientists think blowing up an incoming asteroid is a bad idea and prefer efforts to redirect a killer rock. Among the suggestions, attach giant engines to it and push it away, or park a huge spaceship next to it, and the ship's gravity would be just enough to nudge the asteroid's path away from Earth. I am VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, a new song by Meghan Trainor. China's parliament has adopted a sweeping new national security law that critics say will further enshrine and expand the country's suppression of political dissent. The largely ceremonial National People's Congress passed the bill today with 144 yes votes and one abstention, according to the official Xinhua News Agency. The law allows authorities to take all necessary measures to safeguard territorial sovereignty and ensure full control over the country's already tightly censored internet. I spoke with Nicholas Becklin in Hong Kong. He's the East Asia Director for Amnesty International. What is the reaction of, your reaction and the reaction of your organization to this law?
We were very concerned when we saw the initial two drafts of the law, because the law very clearly intends to expand the definition of what can be considered a national security issue or national security concern for the Chinese state. And this law really pushes forward the concept that the Communist Party's power and its monopoly on power is an integral part of national security. And therefore, that anyone who criticizes the party or is considered by the party to be a threat or a factor of instability can be immediately labeled as a national security a threat, and therefore be prosecuted, arrested, and jailed under very specious national security crimes. Of course, it's not new that China conflates national security and the political power of the Communist Party, and countless activists and dissidents and human rights activists have been sentenced under state security crimes in the criminal law. Incitement to subvert state power, for instance, is a classic one. It's the one under which Nobel Peace Prize Liu Xiaobo is serving currently an 11-year prison term. But the concern here is that Xi Jinping is really pushing national security as one of the major theme of it. Leadership. There are five pieces of legislation that either have been already passed or are going to be passed very shortly. And that represents a considerable expansion of the power of a new security apparatus. Was mandated to protect national security, but in fact goes far beyond this. If you look at the law, it's actually a catalog of everything that the party and the government thinks may be a problem in the future or a factor of instability. That's why it lists things such as improper cultural interference, religious movement, the environment, social unrest. Pretty much every issue that is of concern to the government is listed as a national security item under this law.
Well, so, see, two of those things could be considered as in regard to, say, Tibet or Xinjiang.
Well, I think very clearly for issues such as Xinjiang and Tibet, the state has long used the national security crime of separatism or incitement to separatism to suppress any kind of expression of discontent or even a position that not in line with the official orthodoxy of the state. This really, I think, is an unmistakable sign of the political hardening that we're witnessing at the moment under Xi Jinping, really will be probably here for a long time. There's another piece of legislation that touches on national security that is under consideration, which is a law on NGOs that receive foreign funding, whose control and supervision would be put in the hands of the police with strong national security review mechanisms. So we can see that this is a concerted push. This is very unusual for China to have five pieces of legislation on one topic in such a short time. And this is really a new theme that is very alarming, because we've seen that national security is already the source of widespread human rights violations and limitations on freedom of expression and assembly. And it seems that the government is doubling down on this technique.
Okay, well, I thank you very much for speaking with me today.
Thanks, you're very welcome.
That is Nicholas Becklin. He's the East Asia Director for Amnesty International, and he was speaking from Hong Kong.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
Put together a pop star and a multiple Grammy winner, and you get something new. Meghan Trainor teamed up with John Legend for her latest song called Like I'm Gonna Lose You. Stopping by is VOA's David Byrd and Larry London to chat about it.
You might be familiar with her mega hit, It's All About That Bass, or maybe her latest tune, Dear Future Husband. But Meghan Trainor has got a new song coming out. Larry London stops by to talk about it. Larry, what is Megan's new song coming out?
The new song is called Like I'm Gonna Lose You. It's a beautiful ballad, which is a definite change for Meghan Trainor from the bubblegum pop sound that we've come to know and love over the last year or so. But she and John Legend have recorded this song together. She wrote the song. She never really imagined that John Legend would actually agree to sing it. She said when he arrived in the studios the day they recorded it, she actually burst into tears. She said it was so intense to actually record this song with him. She debuted the song at the Billboard Music Awards show. They sang it together live on the air in May.
I found myself dreaming in silver and gold, like a scene from a movie that every broken heart knows. We were walking on moonlight and you pulled me close.
Wow. Now, speaking of Billboard Music Awards, she's got a shelf full of those as well.
A shelf, right? A virtual collection of two that she won out of nine nominations. And, of course, John Legend himself has won many, many awards, nine Grammys. So this is quite a powerhouse combination of artists.
And John Legend also teamed up with Kelly Clarkson on her latest CD for a tune. So is he, like, kind of making the duet circuit now?
He's doing the duets. And he's also working with a variety of artists that you wouldn't normally associate him with. Of course, he won an Oscar with Common for, you know, the song Glory from Selma. So that's tremendous. And you know, he just is kind of branching off a little bit in his own direction and working with some people that have given him a chance to get exposure in a kind of music that he typically isn't known to do.
Now, you and I were chatting a little bit before. Meghan Trainor is also kind of a spokesperson for people like me who struggle with their weight
and
a little
me.
Bit. because she's not, you know, your twiggy kind of pop star.
Right.
She is a little bit heavier. But she's made a point of encouraging particularly young women who struggle a lot with body image anyway, in her audience, the pop audience, to, you know, to accept themselves.
Exactly. And she you know, she's working on a number of different things that are about self-awareness and positive image. One of them, she's created her own line of cosmetics called Full Beauty Brands. And she wants people to understand that this is something that's designed for women of all sizes and shapes. She herself never saw herself as a pop star. She openly admits she started off as a writer. She wrote songs for Rascal Flatts and Hunter Hayes. It was L.A. Reid who said, no, we've got to release this with you singing it. You know, when she was came to him with All About That Bass. And so that's how the story started. She didn't see herself singing that song.
Wow. And the world, as they say, changed. All right. Well, thanks a lot, Larry. You know, you can always hit up Larry on Twitter, VOA_music. Here at International Edition, it's VOA_IE. Listen for Larry's show, Border Crossings. You can also find it on our website. That's www.voanews.com.
I'm going to love you.
Music by Meghan Trainor and John Legend. Well, that's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks very much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Every year, the U.S. State Department prepares detailed reports assessing respect for human rights around the world. The reports, required by law, evaluate how the governments of every country and a number of territories demonstrate respect for human dignity and individual freedoms. Lawmakers, as well as authorities in the executive branch, use the reports to help shape our nation's foreign policies. They also signal to the human rights defenders and activists under siege that our government recognizes their struggle and stands with civil society in its efforts to preserve human rights. For far too many people, 2014 was defined by suffering and abuse perpetrated by terrorist groups exploiting religious discourse and divisions to advance their totalitarian ideology, and by governments like Syria acting repressively in the name of combating terrorism. Meanwhile, governments in China, Egypt, Eritrea, Ethiopia, Iran, Russia, and Saudi Arabia, among others, continue to stifle free and open media and the development of civil society through the imprisonment of journalists, bloggers, and nonviolent critics. As in previous years, human rights conditions in Zimbabwe are a particular concern. The most important human rights problems remain the government's targeting for torture, abuse, arrest, and harassment of members of non-ZANU-PF parties and civil society activists. There also continues to be a partisan application of the rule of law by security forces and the judiciary, as well as restrictions on civil liberties. The government took limited steps to punish security sector officials and ZANU-PF supporters who committed violations, but impunity continued to be a problem. The United States has seen its own share of racial discord and unrest in the last year. We approach this report with great self-awareness, but we also understand that when human rights is the issue, every country, including our own, has room to improve. We are committed to the work of advancing universal rights, building the partnerships that will move us forward, helping every man, woman, and child live up to their potential. In cases of nations such as Zimbabwe, We are also committed to speaking out for those unable to do so for themselves.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.